going. The magistrate says that the man who finds a father will get 300 pieces of silver. So, my price is 300 pieces of silver. These were my first words to Kichijiro, and as I spoke them, a bitter laugh crossed my face. Judas had sold our Lord for 30 pieces of silver. I was worth 10 times as much. "It's dangerous to go alone," he said. As though somewhat relieved, he caught up with me and kept beating the bushes with the branch of a tree as he walked along by my side. The crying of the birds broke through the darkness of the evening. "Father, I know a place where there are Christians. It's safe there. Let's go. Tonight we can sleep here. Tomorrow we'll set out." Without waiting for my answer, he squatted down, cleverly picked up twigs that were not damped by the evening mist, took out a flintstone from his pouch and lit a fire. "You must be hungry," he said, and he took from his pouch a few dried fish. When my starving eyes caught sight of them, the saliva began to flow freely in my mouth. Since morning, I had had nothing to eat except a little uncooked rice and cucumber, so that the food Kichijiro waved before my eyes was tempting indeed. As the fire broke into flame and the salted fish was slowly roasted, an unbearably delicious scent was wafted to my nostrils. "Won't you eat?" Baring my teeth, I greedily seized upon the dried fish. One slice was enough to make me compromise with Kichijiro. With a look half of satisfaction and half of contempt, he stared at me as I ate ravenously. And all the time he kept chewing grass as though it were tobacco or something like that. The surrounding country was now wrapped in darkness. The mountains began to grow chilly. The misty rain seemed to penetrate my body. I lay down beside the fire as though to sleep. But sleep was out of the question. For if I once lost consciousness, Kichijiro would steal away. He would sell me as he had sold his companions. Perhaps he would do so tonight. For a penniless beggar like himself, 300 pieces of silver was surely a tantalizing temptation. As I closed my eyes, behind my wearied eyelids, there arose vividly the picture I had seen from the plateau, the picture of the sea and the islands. The sea glistening like a needle, the islands spread out over its surface. I had crossed over this beautiful sea, blessed by so many missionaries. I recalled the days when the churches had been decorated with flowers, when the Christians had brought gifts of fish and rice. At that time there had been a seminary here, where the students sang in Latin, just as we had done in Portugal. Valignano had told us that there was even a time when they played on the harp and the organ, much to the delight of the feudal lords. "Father, are you awake?" I made no answer, but from half-opened eyes I looked at my companion. If he were to steal off somewhere in the night, it would surely be to summon the government officials. He was watching my sleeping breath, and then, little by little, he began to move off. I watched him move stealthily away like an animal. This would be his chance to go away, but to my surprise he returned to the fire with a sigh. With both hands he kept piling fresh dry wood on the ashes, and all the time he kept sighing as though in anguish. The red flame of the fire fell upon his cheeks and I could see his silhouette in the night. And then, overcome with the day's exhaustion, I fell asleep. Sometimes I would open my eyes, and always there was the figure of Kichijiro sitting beside the fire. The next day we continued to walk under the merciless rays of the sun. White steam rose up from the earth, still sodden from yesterday's rain, and beyond the mountain a cloud was glittering brightly. For some time I had been suffering from a headache and a parched throat. Whether or not Kichijiro noticed the pain in my face, I do not know, but sometimes he would slowly cross the road, pierce with his staff a snake hidden in the bushes, and put it into his dirty bag. "We peasants eat these big snakes as medicine," he said, showing his yellow teeth and laughing. "Why did you not sell me last night for 300 pieces of silver?" I thought. and there arose in my mind that terribly dramatic scene at the supper when Christ turned to Judas with the words, "What thou dost, do quickly." Priest though I am, I find it difficult to grasp the full meaning of these words. Dragging my feet wearily along beside Kijidiro amidst the rising steam, I kept turning them over in my mind. What emotion had filled the breast of Christ when he ordered away the man who was to betray him for 30 pieces of silver? Was it anger or resentment? Or did these words arise from his love? If it was anger, then at this instant Christ excluded from salvation this man alone of all the men in the world. And then our Lord allowed one man to fall into eternal damnation. But it could not be so. Christ wanted to save even Judas. If not, he would never have made him one of his disciples. And yet why did Christ not stop him when he began to slip from the path of righteousness? This was a problem I had not understood, even as a seminarian. I asked many priests about it. Certainly I must have asked Father Ferreira also, but I cannot recall what his answer was. This very fact indicates that he gave no real solution. These words were not uttered in anger or hatred. They were words of disgust, someone had said. But what kind of disgust? Were they disgust for everything in Judas? Did Christ at that moment cease to love him? By no means, came the answer. Take the example of a husband betrayed by his wife. He continues to love her, but he never forgives the fact that she, his wife, should betray him. This is the feeling of the husband who loves his wife but feels disgust at such behaviour. And Christ's attitude toward Judas was something like that. This conventional answer failed to satisfy me even as a young man. In fact, even now, I cannot understand. If it is not blasphemous to say so, I have the feeling that Judas was no more than the unfortunate puppet for the glory of that drama which was the life and death of Christ. What thou dost, do quickly. Yet I could not say such words to Kijidiro, one reason being that I wanted to protect my own life, the other that I hoped ardently that he would not heap betrayal upon betrayal. This path is narrow. It's difficult to walk here, said my companion. Is there a river anywhere? I asked. The parched, dry feeling in my throat was now unbearable. With the hint of a laugh, Kichijiro looked me over. Do you want water? You ate too much of that dried fish. Like the previous day, crows were flying around, forming an enormous crescent in the sky. Looking up, a flash of white light struck my eyes, almost blinding me. I began to regret my compromise and my weakness. For a piece of dried fish, I had made an irrevocable failure. I searched for the marsh, but in vain. The warm wind was blowing in from the sea. The river, the river, the river, the river. There isn't even a stream here. Can't you wait? Said Kijijiro. But without even waiting for my answer, he ran down the slope. When his appearance was lost from sight behind a crag, the surroundings suddenly became deadly silent, except for the dry sound of insects fluttering in the grass. A lizard crawled uneasily over a stone and then fled away speedily. Its furtive face, as it stared at me, reminded me of the Kichijiro who had just vanished from sight. Had he really gone in search of water for me? Or had he gone to betray me, to tell someone that I was here? Grasping my staff and moving on, I found that the dryness in my throat was even more unbearable, and now I realized only too clearly that the wretch had deliberately made me eat the dried fish. I recalled the words of the Gospel, how Christ had said, "I thirst," and one of the soldiers put a spongeful of vinegar on hyssop and held it to his mouth. I closed my eyes. In the distance, a hoarse call echoed as though someone was looking for me. Father! Father! Kichijiro ran, dragging his feet in the old slovenly way and carrying a pitcher of water. Are you running away? He asked as he looked sorrowfully down at me. I snatched the pitcher of water that he offered me, and placing it to my lips, drank greedily and shamelessly. The water poured down through my hands, wetting my knees. "Father, you were running away. Don't you trust me?" "I don't want to hurt your feelings," I said. "We're both tired. Please go away. Leave me alone."
"Alone? Where would you go? It's dangerous."
"I know a village of hidden Christians. There is a church there and a father."
"A father?"
Unconsciously, I raised my voice. I couldn't believe that there might be a priest other than myself on the island. I looked at Kichijiro with growing suspicion.
"Yes, father, and not a Japanese. I've heard so."
"Impossible."
"Father, you don't trust me."
He stood there, tearing at the grass and snivelling in his weak voice. "No one trusts me."
"And yet you know how to look after yourself. Mokichi and Ichizo have sunk to the bottom of the sea like stones, and yet..."
"Mokichi was strong, like a strong shoot. But a weak shoot like me will never grow, no matter what you do." He seemed to feel that I had dealt him a severe rebuke, because with a look like a whipped dog, he glanced backwards. Yet I had not said these words with the intention of rebuking him. I was only giving expression to a sad reflection that was rising in my mind. Kichijiro was right in saying that all men are not saints and heroes. How many of our Christians, if only they had been born in another age from this persecution, would never have been confronted with the problem of apostasy or martyrdom, but would have lived blessed lives of faith until the very hour of death.
"I have nowhere to go. I'm just wandering around the mountains," complained Kichijiro.
A feeling of pity surged up within my breast. I bade him kneel down, and in obedience to my command, he tremblingly bent his knees down to the earth.
"Do you feel like confessing for Mokichi and Ichizo?" I asked.
"Men are born in two categories, the strong and the weak, the saints and the commonplace, the heroes and those who respect them. In time of persecution, the strong are burnt in the flames and drowned in the sea, but the weak, like Kichijiro, lead a vagabond life in the mountains. As for you," I now spoke to myself, "which category do you belong to?"
"Were it not for the consciousness of your priesthood and your pride, perhaps you, like Kichijiro, would trample on the Fumi."
"Our Lord is crowned with thorns. Our Lord is crucified." With all the simplicity of a child imitating its mother, Kichijiro repeated my words one by one, while a lizard once again crawled over and around the white surface of the rock. In the woods resounded the voice of the cicada. The scent of the grass was wafted over the white rock. Then, coming along the road we had traversed, I heard the sound of footsteps. Men, looking in our direction and hastening their steps, made their way through the bushes.
"Father, forgive me."
Still kneeling on the bare ground, Kichijiro cried out in a voice choked with tears.
"I am weak. I am not a strong person like Mokichi and Ichizo."
Already, the men were seizing me and dragging me to my feet. One of them, with a gesture of contempt, threw into the face of Kichijiro, still kneeling, a number of tiny silver coins. Without a word, they pushed me in front of them. Stumbling and reeling, I was driven along the dry road. Once I looked back, but already the tiny face of my betrayer was far in the distance. That face, with its fearful eyes, like a spider.
Chapter 5. The world outside was flooded with sunlight, but the interior of the village seemed strangely dark. While he was being dragged here, children and adults alike, dressed in rags, had kept staring at him with glimmering eyes, like animals, from between the thatch-roofed huts. Perhaps they were Christians, he reflected, and he made an effort to force a smile to his lips. But it was all an illusion. There was no response. Once a naked child tottered up to where he was, but its mother, a woman with dishevelled hair, rushed forward, tumbling over herself in haste, and, clasping the child in her arms, hurried back again.
To calm his anguished trembling that night, the priest thought earnestly about a man who had been dragged from the Garden of Gethsemane to the palace of Caiaphas. Once outside the village, his eyes were suddenly dazzled by the glare of the sun. He felt overcome with giddiness. The fellow behind, constantly muttering something, kept pushing him on. Forcing a smile, the priest asked if he might be permitted to rest for a moment, but the other, hard-faced and grim, shook his head in refusal. The fields beneath the glaring sun were heavy with the smell of manure. The skylarks chattered with pleasure in the sky. Great trees, the names of which he did not know, cast a pleasant shadow on the road, and the leaves gave forth a fresh sound as they rustled in the breeze. The road through the fields gradually narrowed, and when they reached the far side, they found a hollow stretching into the mountain. Here there was a tiny hut made of twigs. Its black shadow fell on the slimy earth. Here four or five men and women, clad in peasant clothing, their hands bound, were sitting together on the grass. They seemed to be talking among themselves, but when they recognized the priest, they opened their mouths in amazement. Having brought the priest to the group, the guards seemed to think their work was done and began to exchange chatter and banter, laughing all the time. They didn't even seem preoccupied lest the priest might escape. As the priest sat down on the ground, the men and women bowed their heads respectfully. For some time he remained silent. A fly attempted to lick the perspiration which was flowing down his forehead, and then it kept buzzing persistently around his face. As he turned his ears to the dull sound of its wings and felt the warm rays of the sun on his back, a glow of well-being gradually began to penetrate his whole body. At last, he had been captured. This was indeed difficult to stomach. But on the other hand, he had never expected to find such nonchalance here, and he began to ask himself if it might not all be an illusion. For some indefinable reason, the word Sabbath, day of rest, rose to his mind. The guards were talking and laughing among themselves as if nothing were afoot. The bright sun fell cheerfully on the bushes and the hut in the little hollow. And so this was the day of his capture, the day he had looked forward to with mingled fear and anxiety. Could it really be a day of such peace and calm? Yet somehow or other he also felt an inexpressible dissatisfaction, a kind of delusion that he was not privileged to be a tragic hero like so many martyrs and like Christ himself. "Father!" It was one of the men, with a decaying eye, who spoke, moving his manacled wrists. "Father, what happened?" At this, all the others raised their heads and, with faces filled with curiosity, waited for the priest's answer. They were like a bunch of ignorant beasts, he thought, quite unaware of the fate that awaited them. When he explained that he had been captured in the mountains, they seemed not to understand what he said, and the man, putting his hand to his ear, asked the same question again. Finally, they seemed to get the meaning. "Ah!" A sigh, devoid of either assent or emotion, rose from among them.
"Doesn't he speak well?" exclaimed one of the women, like a child, marvelling at the priest's command of Japanese. "He's really clever, isn't he?"
The guards only kept laughing at all this, making no attempt to scold the men and women, nor to forbid them to speak. Indeed, the one-eyed man, with some degree of familiarity, began to speak to one of the guards, who answered him with a pleasant smile.
"What are those men doing?" whispered the priest to one of the women.
And she answered that they were waiting for the arrival of the government officials who were supposed to come to the village.
"Anyhow, Father," she went on, "we are Christians. Those men are not Christians, they are Gentiles."
Obviously she saw deep meaning in this distinction.
"Won't you eat something, Father?" she continued. And with her manacled wrists she succeeded in taking from her bosom a couple of small cucumbers.
Then, nibbling at one herself, she gave the other to the priest. When he bit it, his mouth was filled with its green stench. Since coming to this country, he reflected, he had caused nothing but hardship to these poor Christians, and he nibbled at the cucumber with his front teeth. He had received from them the little hut in which he had dwelt. They had given him the clothing he now wore. He had eaten their food. Now it was his turn to give something. But what could he give? The only thing he had to offer was his life and his death.
"Your name?" he asked.
"Monica."
Her answer was somewhat bashful, as though her Christian name was the only ornament she possessed in the whole world. What missionary had given the name of Augustine's mother to this woman whose body was reeking with the stench of fish?
"And this man?" He made a gesture towards the one-eyed man still talking to the guards.
"You mean Mosemon? His name is Juan."
"What father baptized you?"
"It was not a father, it was a brother. Brother Ishida. You must know him, father."
The priest shook his head. The only person he knew in this country was Garp.
"You don't know him?"
The woman spoke with astonishment as she scrutinized the priest's face.
"Why, he was killed at Unzen."
"But are you all at ease?" Now at last he expressed the doubt that had been in his heart. "Don't you realize that we are all going to die in the same way?" The woman lowered her eyes and stared intently at the bushes at her feet. Once again, a fly, enticed by the smell of humanity, buzzed around his neck.
"I don't know," she said. "Brother Ishida used to say that when we go to heaven, we will find there everlasting peace and happiness. There we will not have to pay taxes every year, nor worry about hunger and illness. There will be no hard labor there. We have nothing but troubles in the world, so we have to work hard."
"Father, isn't it true that there is no such anguish in heaven?"
He felt like shouting out, "Heaven is not the sort of place you think it is," but he restrained himself. These peasants had learned their catechism like children. They dreamt of a heaven in which there was no bitter taxation and no oppression. Who was he to put a cruel end to their happy dream? "Yes," he said, blinking his eyes. "There nothing can be stolen from us. We can be deprived of nothing." But now yet another question rose to his lips. "Do you know a father by the name of Ferreira?" The woman shook her head. Was the very name of Ferreira a word that was not even to be mentioned by the Christians, he asked himself. Suddenly from the cliff above a loud voice rang out. Looking up, the priest saw a smiling little plump samurai, somewhat advanced in years, followed by two peasants. When he saw the old man smile, he realized that this was the samurai who had conducted the investigation at Tomogi. "Hot, isn't it?" The samurai, waving his fan, came slowly down the cliff as he spoke. "From now on it gets really hot. The open fields become unbearable." Monica, Juan, and the other men and women put their manacled wrists on their knees and bowed politely. Out of the side of his eye, the old man saw the priest bow his head along with the others, but he ignored him and walked straight on. As he passed, there was a dry swish of his cloak. His clothes gave forth a sweet perfume. "We've had no evening showers these days. The road is all dusty. It's a nuisance for old people like us to come so far." He sat down in the middle of the prisoners, cooling his head and neck with his white fan. "Don't keep on causing trouble to an old man like me," he said. The light of the sun made his laughing face look so flat that the priest recalled the statues of the Buddha he had seen in Macau. These had never aroused within him an emotion similar to that called forth by the face of Christ. Only the flies kept buzzing around. At one time they would graze the necks of the Christians, then they would fly in the direction of the old man, and then back again. "It wasn't from hatred that we arrested you. You must see our reasons. Why should we arrest you when you pay your taxes and work hard? We know better than anyone that the peasants are the backbone of the country." Mingled with the whirling of the flies' wings was the swish of the old man's fan. From afar, the clucking of the chickens was carried by the fresh, warm wind to the place where they were. "Is this the famous cross-examination?" thought the priest, his eyes cast down like the others. All those Christians and missionaries who had been tortured and punished, had they heard the gentle voice of persuasion prior to their suffering?
had they too heard the buzzing of flies in a sleepy atmosphere like this? He had thought to be overcome with fear and trembling, but, strange to say, no terror rose up within his heart. He had no acute realization of the proximity of torture and death. He felt like a man who, on a rainy day, thinks of a sunlit mountain far away.
"I'll give you time to think it over. Afterwards, give me a reasonable answer," said the old man, bringing the conversation to an abrupt end as the forced smile faded from his lips. Now there appeared on his face instead that avaricious pride the priest had seen so often on the faces of the merchants at Macau. "Off with you," he said. The guards stood up among the bushes and urged on their captives. The priest went to stand up with the others, but the old man, twisting his face up like a monkey, and for the first time revealing hatred and rancor in his flashing eyes, shouted out, "You!" he cried, drawing up his tiny figure to its full stature and putting one hand on his sword. "Stay here!" With a faint smile, the priest sat down again among the bushes. The little old fellow straightened up and, bent back like a rooster, he strutted along, obviously showing the prisoners his determination not to be beaten by a foreigner. A monkey, the priest reflected. He needn't stand there with his hand on his sword. I'm not going to run away. He watched the group as, all manacled, they climbed the height and disappeared from sight into the distant plateau. "Hoc passionis tempore pius adauge gratiam." The prayer rose up to his dry lips bitterly. "Lord," he murmured, "do not increase their suffering. Already it is too heavy for them. Until today they have been able to bear it. Can you give even more trials to people already crushed with the burdens of taxation, officialdom, and cruelty?" The old man put a cup to his lips and wet his throat, much as a chicken would sip water. "I have met quite a number of fathers," he said. "I have cross-examined them sometimes." He moistened his lips and spoke now with a servile voice which was in striking contrast with his previous attitude. "You understand Japanese?" A few wisps of cloud hung in the sky. The hollow began to darken a little. In the shrubs round about, the stifling humming of insects began to make itself heard for the first time. "Peasants are fools," he said. "It all depends on you whether or not they are to be set free." The priest did not quite understand what he was getting at, but the expression on the other's face made it clear that the cunning old rascal was setting some trap for him. "Peasants cannot think for themselves. Even if they talk the thing over, they will come to no conclusion. But if you say a single word..."
"What are you trying to say?" asked the priest.
"Apostatize! Apostatize!" The old man laughed and waved his fan as he spoke.
"And supposing I refuse," the priest replied quietly, laughing all the time, "then you'll kill me, I suppose?"
"No, no," said the old man, "we won't do that. If we did that, the peasants would become even more stubborn. We made that mistake in Omura and Nagasaki. The Christians there are a stubborn crowd."
The old man heaved a deep sigh as he spoke, but it was immediately clear to the priest that the whole thing was a comedy. He even began to feel a secret joy in teasing this old fellow who looked like a monkey.
"Now, if you are really a father at heart, you ought to feel pity for the Christians. Isn't that so?"
Unconsciously, the priest felt his mouth drop. What a simpleton this old fellow was! Did he think to win something with this childish logic? What he had forgotten, however, was that if this official was as simple as a child, he was equally simple in flaring up in anger when defeated in argument.
"What about it?" said the old man.
"Punish me alone," said the priest, shrugging his shoulders and laughing. An angry colour rose up to the forehead of the old man. From the far distant clouds, a faint dull roar of thunder rumbled.
"It is because of you that they must suffer," concluded the old man.
They pushed him into the little hut. Through those brushwood walls, standing on the naked soil, the white rays of sunlight penetrated like pieces of thread. Outside, he could hear the muffled voices of the chattering guards. Where had they brought the Christians? They had simply vanished from sight, and that was all. Sitting on the ground and clasping his knees, he thought about Monica and her one-eyed companion. Then he thought about the village of Tomogi, about Omatsu and Ichizo and Mokichi, and his heart grew heavy. If only he had a moment for reflection, he might at least have given those poor Christians a brief blessing. But he hadn't even thought of it. This was proof that he hadn't had a moment's respite. At least he should have asked them what date it was, what day of the month it was. But he had forgotten that too. Since coming to this country, he seemed to have lost all sense of time, of months and days, so that now he could no longer reckon how many days had passed since Easter or what saint's feast was celebrated today. Since he had no rosary, he began to recite the paters and aves on the five fingers of his hand. But just as the water dribbles back down from the mouth of the man whose lips are locked by sickness, the prayer remained empty and hollow on his lips. Rather was he drawn by the voices of the guards outside the hut. What was so funny that they should keep raising their voices and laughing heartily? His thoughts turned to the firelit garden and the servants, the figures of those men holding black, flaming torches and utterly indifferent to the fate of one man. These guards, too, were men. They were indifferent to the fate of others. This was the feeling that their laughing and talking stirred up in his heart. Sin, he reflected, is not what it is usually thought to be. It is not to steal and tell lies. Sin is for one man to walk brutally over the life of another and to be quite oblivious of the wounds he has left behind. And then, for the first time, a real prayer rose up in his heart. Suddenly, a ray of bright light broke upon his closed eyelids. Someone was opening the door of the hut, quietly and stealthily, so as to make no noise. Next, tiny and menacing eyes were peering in at him. When the priest looked up, the intruder quickly tried to withdraw. "He's quiet, isn't he?" Someone else was now speaking to the guard who had looked in, and now the door opened. A flood of light rushed into the room, and there appeared the figure of a man, not the old samurai, but another, without a sword. "Señor, gracia," he said. So he was speaking Portuguese. The pronunciation was strange and halting, but it was certainly Portuguese. "Señor." "Palazera a Dios nuestro, señor." The sudden inrush of blinding light had made the priest somewhat dizzy. He listened to the words. Yes, there were mistakes here and there, but there was no doubt about the meaning. "Don't be surprised," went on the other in Portuguese. "In Nagasaki and Hirado, there are a number of interpreters like myself. But I see that you, Father, have quite a grasp of our language. Could you guess where I learned my Portuguese?" Without waiting for an answer, the man went on talking, and as he spoke, he kept moving his fan, just like the old samurai had done. "Thanks to you Portuguese fathers, seminaries were built in Arima and Amakusa and Umura. But this doesn't mean that I'm an apostate. I was baptized all right, but from the beginning I had no wish to be a Christian nor a brother. I'm only the son of a court samurai. Nothing but learning could make me great in the world." The fellow was earnestly stressing the fact that he was not a Christian. The priest sat in the dark, with an expressionless face, listening to him as he prattled on. "Why don't you say something?" exclaimed the man, getting angry now. "The fathers always ridiculed us. I knew Father Cabral. He had nothing but contempt for everything Japanese. He despised our houses, he despised our language, he despised our food and our customs, and yet he lived in Japan. Even those of us who graduated from the seminary, he did not allow to become priests." As he talked, recalling incidents from the past, his voice became increasingly shrill and violent. Yet the priest, sitting there with his hands clasping his knees, knew that the fellow's anger was not altogether unjustified. He had heard something about Cabral from Valignano in Macau. He remembered how Valignano had spoken sadly of the Christians and priests who had left the church because of this man's attitude towards Japan. "I'm not like Cabral," he said finally.
"Really?"
The fellow spoke with a laugh. "I'm not so sure."
"Why?"
In the darkness, the priest could not make out what kind of expression the fellow wore, but he somehow guessed that this low, laughing voice issued from a face filled with hatred and resentment. Accustomed as he was to hearing the Christian's confessions with closed eyes, he could make such conjectures confidently. But, he thought as he looked toward the other, what this fellow is fighting against is not Father Cabral, but the fact that he once received baptism.
"Won't you come outside, Father? I don't think we need now fear that you will run away."
"You never know," said the priest with the shadow of a smile. "I'm not a saint. I'm scared of death."
"Father, sometimes courage only causes trouble for other people. We call that blind courage. And many of the priests, fanatically filled with this blind courage, forget that they are only causing trouble to the Japanese."
"Is that all the missionaries have done? Have they only caused trouble?"
"If you force on people things that they don't want, they are inclined to say, 'Thanks for nothing.' And Christian doctrine is something like that here. We have our own religion. We don't want a new foreign one. I myself learned Christian doctrine in the seminary, but I tell you, I don't think it ought to be introduced into this country."
"Your and my way of thinking are different," said the priest, quietly dropping his voice. "If they were the same, I would not have crossed the sea from far away to come to this country." This was his first controversy with the Japanese. Since the time of Xavier, had many fathers engaged in such an exchange with the Buddhists? Valignano had warned him not to underrate the intelligence of the Japanese. They were well versed in the art of controversy, he had said.
"Well then, let me ask a question." Opening and closing his fan as he spoke, he came to the attack. "The Christians say that their Deus is the source of love and mercy, the source of goodness and virtue, whereas the Buddhas are all men and cannot possess these qualities. Is this your stand also, Father?"
"A Buddha cannot escape death any more than we can. He is something different from the Creator."
"Only a father who is ignorant of Buddhist teaching could say such a thing. In fact, you cannot say that the Buddhas are no more than men. There are three kinds of Buddhas: Hōshin, Goshin, and Oka. The Oka Buddha shows 8 aspects for delivering human beings and giving them benefits. But the Hōshin has neither beginning nor end, and he is unchangeable. It is written in the sutras that the Buddha is everlasting and never changes. It is only a Christian who could regard the Buddhas as mere human beings. We don't think that way at all."
The fellow kept pouring out his answers as though he had learnt them all by rote. Undoubtedly, he had examined many missionaries in the past and had kept reflecting on the best way of beating them down. Obviously, he had ended up by using big words that he himself did not understand. "But you hold that everything exists naturally, that the world has neither beginning nor end," said the priest, seizing on the other's weak point and taking the offensive.
"Yes, that is our position."
"But an object without life must either be moved from outside by something else or from within. How were the Buddhas born? Moreover, I understand that these Buddhas have merciful hearts, but antecedent to all this, how was the world made? Our Deus is the source of his own existence. He created man. He gave existence to all things."
"Then the Christian God created evil men. Is that what you were saying? Is evil also the work of your Deus?"
The interpreter laughed softly as he spoke, enjoying his victory.
"No, no," cried the priest, shaking his head. "God created everything for good, and for this good he bestowed on man the power of thought. But we men sometimes use this power of discrimination in the wrong way. This is evil."
The interpreter clicked his tongue in contempt, but the priest had scarcely expected him to be convinced by his explanation. This kind of dialogue soon ceased to be dialogue, becoming a play of words in which one tried vigorously to down one's opponent.
"Stop this sophistry," shouted the interpreter. "You may satisfy peasants with their wives and children in this way, but you can't beguile me. But now let me put you one more question. If it is true that God is really loving and merciful, how do you explain the fact that he gives so many trials and sufferings of all kinds to man on his way to heaven?"
"Sufferings of every kind? I think you are missing the point. If only man faithfully observes the commandments of our Deus, he should be able to live in peace. If we have the desire to eat something, we can satisfy it. God does not order us to die of hunger. All we are asked to do is to honour God our Creator, and that is enough. Or again, when we cannot cast away the desires of the flesh, God does not order us to avoid all contact with women. Rather, does he tell us to have one wife and do his divine will." As he finished speaking, he felt that his answer had been well framed. In the darkness of the hut, he could clearly feel that the interpreter was lost for words and reduced to silence.
"Enough! We can't go on forever with this useless banter," said the other angrily, now passing into Japanese. "I didn't come here for this nonsense."
Far in the distance, a cock was crowing. From the slightly open door, a single ray of light penetrated the darkness of the room, and in it a myriad of dust particles were dancing. The priest looked at them intently. The interpreter breathed a deep sigh.
"If you don't apostatize," he said, "the peasants will be suspended in the pit."
The priest could not quite understand the meaning of what he was saying.
"Yes, 5 peasants will be suspended upside down in the pit for several days."
"Suspended in the pit?"
"Yes, Father, unless you apostatize."
The priest was silent. Were these words serious, or were they a threat? He peered into the darkness, his eyes gleaming.
"Father, have you ever heard of Inoue? He's the magistrate. Sometime you'll meet him face to face for investigation."
"Inoue." Only with these syllables did the interpreter's Portuguese seem to come to life. They hit into the priest's ears, and his whole body instantly shook and trembled.
"The fathers who apostatized after Inoue's cross-examination are Fathers Porro, Pedro, Cassola, and Father Ferreira."
"Father Ferreira?"
"Yes. Do you know him?"
"No, I don't know him," cried the priest excitedly, shaking his head. "He belongs to a different congregation. I've never heard his name. I've never met him."
"Is this father alive now?" "He's alive, all right. In fact, he has taken a Japanese name, and he lives in a mansion in Nagasaki together with his wife. He is in good repute now."
Suddenly there arose before the priest's eyes the streets of a Nagasaki he had never seen. For some reason he could not understand, this city of his imagination was filled with labyrinthine roads, and the golden sun was glittering on the windows of the tiny houses, and there, walking along the street, wearing clothes just like those of this interpreter, was Ferreira. No, this could not be. Such a fancy was ludicrous. "I don't believe you," he said. But with a scornful laugh, the interpreter went out. The door closed again behind him. The white ray of sunlight was suddenly extinguished. Once again, just as before, the voices of the guards resounded against the walls of the hut.
"A selfish rascal, if ever there was one," the interpreter was saying. "But anyhow, he'll end up by apostatizing."
This was obviously a reference to himself, the priest thought, and, clasping his knees, he silently ruminated on the 4 names the interpreter had trotted out as if having learnt them by rote. Fathers Porro and Pedro he did not know. He felt sure that at Macau he had heard the name of Father Cassola. This missionary was Portuguese, but, unlike himself, he had come not from Macau, but from the Spanish-controlled Manila, and he had secretly entered Japan. After his arrival there had been no news of him, and the Society of Jesus had taken it for granted that he had met with a glorious martyrdom. But behind these 3 figures was the face of Ferreira. Ferreira, for whom he had been searching since his arrival in Japan. If the words of the interpreter were not simply a threat, this Ferreira, too, as the rumour had said, had betrayed the church at the hands of the magistrate Inoue. If even Ferreira had apostatized, would he have the strength to endure the sufferings now in store for him? A terrible anguish rose up in his breast. Violently, he shook his head, trying to control the ugly imaginings and the words that rose up to his throat like nausea. But the more he tried to crush this picture, the more vividly it came before his eyes, eluding the control of his will. Exaudinos, pater omnipotens, admittere digneris sanctum qui custodiat, foveat protegat visitet, atque defendat omnes habitantes. Repeating the prayer again and again, he tried wildly to distract his attention, but the prayer could not tranquillize his agonized heart. Lord, why are you silent? Why are you always silent? Evening came. The door opened. One of the guards put some pumpkin in a wooden bowl, placed it in front of him, and went out without saying a word. Raising the thing to his lips, he was struck by its sweaty smell. It seemed to have been cooked 2 or 3 days previously, but in his present mood he would have been glad to eat leather to fill his empty stomach. Before he had finished gulping it down, the flies were circling around his hands. I'm just like a dog, he reflected as he licked his fingers. There had been a time when the missionaries had frequently been invited to meals at the houses of feudal lords and samurai. This was the time when the Portuguese ships had come regularly to the harbours of Hirodo and Yokosura and Fukuda, laden with merchandise. And this was a time, too, according to Valignano, when the missionaries were never in want of bread and wine. They had sat at clean tables, said their grace, and leisurely eaten their repast. And here he was, forgetting even to pray, and pouncing upon this food for dogs. His prayer was not one of thanksgiving to God. It was a prayer of petition for help. It was even an excuse for voicing his complaint and resentment. It was disgraceful for a priest to feel like this. Well he knew that his life was supposed to be devoted to the praise of God, not to the expression of resentment. Yet in this day of trial, when he felt himself like Job in his leprosy, how difficult it was to raise his voice in praise to God. Again the door grated. The same guard appeared. Father, we're going now, he said. Going? Where? To the wharf. As he stood up, he felt giddy from the pangs in his empty stomach. Outside the hut, it was already dusk, and the trees hung their branches languidly, as though they had been exhausted by the heat of the day. Mosquitoes swarmed around their faces. The croaking frogs could be heard in the distance. Three guards stood around him, but none of them seemed to worry lest he might try to escape. They talked to one another in loud voices, sometimes breaking out into laughter. One of them separated himself from the others and began to relieve himself in the bushes. If I wished, thought the priest, I could now break away from the other two and make a getaway. But while this thought was passing through his mind, one of the guards suddenly turned to him and said, Father, that hut was a gloomy place. Yes, he was a good fellow, this guard. And suddenly the priest felt somehow impressed by the fellow's pleasant, laughing face. If he escaped, it was these peasants who would suffer the consequences. Forcing a weak smile, he nodded to his companion. They passed along the road by which they had come in the morning. The priest's hollow eyes were fascinated by the huge trees rising up from the middle of fields, loud with the croaking of frogs. He remembered having seen these trees before. In them, enormous ravens were now flapping their wings and screeching with raucous voice. What a sombre chorus it was, the croak of frogs and the caw of ravens. As they entered the village, the white smoke rising from the scattered houses drove away the swarms of mosquitoes. A man wearing a loincloth stood clasping a child in his arms. Seeing the priest, he opened his mouth like an idiot and burst out laughing. The women, with their eyes sadly lowered, watched the four men as they marched past. Through the village they went, and then out again into the paddy fields. The road went downhill until, at last, a dry breath of salty wind blew into the sunken flesh of the priest's cheeks. Below was a harbour, if, indeed, it could be called a harbour, for it was no more than a landing place of black pebbles heaped together with two forlorn little boats pulled up on the beach. While the guards were pushing poles under the boats, the priest picked up the peach-coloured shells that were lying in the sand and played with them in his hands. They were the only beautiful things he had seen in this long, long day. Putting one to his ear, he listened to the faint, muffled roar that issued forth from its deepest centre. Then, quite suddenly, a dark shudder shook his whole being, and in his hand he crushed that shell with its muffled roar. "Get on board," came the order. The water in the bottom of the boat was white with dust. It was cold to his swollen feet. His feet drenched, both hands clutching the side of the ship, he closed his eyes and sighed. As the boat slowly moved away from land, his sunken eyes rested on the mountains over which he had wandered until this morning. In the evening mist, the dark blue mountain rising up from the sea looked like the swelling breast of a woman. Looking down again to the shore, he caught sight of a man, a beggar, he seemed, running wildly along. As he ran, he was shouting something. Then his feet would sink in the sand, and he would fall down. Yes, it was the man who had betrayed him. Falling down, and then getting up, then falling again, Kichijiro was shouting something in a loud voice. Now it sounded like hissing, now it sounded like weeping. But what he was saying the priest could not make out. Yet he had no inclination to hate the fellow, no feeling of resentment. After all, sooner or later he was bound to be captured, and a feeling of resignation already filled his breast. At last, Kichijiro seemed to realize that he would never catch up, and so he stood, erect like a pole at the water's edge. As the boat moved away, his motionless figure grew smaller and smaller in the evening mist. As night came, the boat entered an inlet. Opening his sleepy, half-closed eyes, he saw that the guards disembarked and were replaced by other men. Their conversation was interspersed with a dialect that seemed rich in consonants, but in his utter exhaustion, the priest did not feel like making the effort to understand what they were saying. The only thing he noticed was that the words Nagasaki and Omura were used frequently, and he felt vaguely that it was in this direction that he was being brought. When he had been in the hut, he had had the strength to pray for the one-eyed man and for the woman who had given him the cucumber, but now he had no longer strength to pray even for himself, much less to speak to others. Where he was being brought, what was going to be done to him, even this did not matter. Closing his eyes, he again fell asleep. Sometimes he would open his eyes, and always he could hear the monotonous sound of the oars in the water. One of the men was rowing, the other two crouched in the boat with dark, sullen faces. "Lord, may thy will be done," he murmured, as though in his sleep. But even though his halting words seemed to resemble those of so many saints who had entrusted their all to the providence of God, he felt that his were different. "What is happening to you?" he asked himself. "Are you beginning to lose your faith?" said the voice from the depths of his being. Yet this voice filled him with disgust. "Where are you going?" he called in a husky voice to the three new guards as he opened his eyes again. But the others remained stiffly silent, as if to threaten him. "Where are you going?" he called again in a loud voice. "Yokose no ura," answered one of the men in a low voice that somehow seemed filled with shame. He had frequently heard the name of Yokose no ura from Valignano. It was a port which had been opened with the permission of the local lord by Froas and Almeida, and the Portuguese ships which until then had called at Hirado began to make use of this port alone. A great Jesuit church had been built on the hill overlooking the harbour, and on it the fathers had erected a huge crucifix, so big indeed that the missionaries could clearly see it from their ships when, after many days and nights of long travel, they finally reached Japan. The Japanese residents also, on Easter Sunday, would walk in procession to the top of the hill, singing hymns and carrying lighted candles in their hands. Even the feudal lords themselves would come here, and some of them eventually received baptism. From the boat, the priest strained his eyes for any trace of a village or its harbour that might be Yokose no Ura. But sea and land alike were painted in the same thick black, nor was any light to be seen. There was absolutely no trace of village or house. Yet the thought was constantly in his mind that somewhere here, as in Tomogi and Goto, there might still be Christians in hiding. If so, did they know that here, in a little boat, crouching with fear and trembling like a wild dog, was a priest? "Where is Yokose no Ura?" he asked one of the guards.
"There's nothing left of it," came the answer.
The village had been burnt to the ground, and its inhabitants had been completely dispersed. The sea and the land were silent as death. Only the dull sound of the waves lapping against the boat broke the silence of the night. "Why have you abandoned us so completely?" he prayed in a weak voice. "Even the village was constructed for you, and have you abandoned it in its ashes? Even when the people are cast out of their homes, have you not given them courage? Have you just remained silent, like the darkness that surrounds me? Why? At least tell me why. We are not strong men like Job, who was afflicted with leprosy as a trial. There is a limit to our endurance. Give us no more suffering." So he prayed. But the sea remained cold, and the darkness maintained its stubborn silence. All that could be heard was the monotonous, dull sound of the oars again and again. "Will I turn out a failure?" he asked himself. He felt that unless grace gave him courage and strength, he could endure no more. The sound of the oars ceased. One of the men faced the sea and yelled, "Is anyone there?" The oars had stopped, but from somewhere beyond, the sound of other oars could be heard.
"It might be someone night fishing. Leave him alone."
This time it was the old man who spoke in a whisper, the one who had been silent until now. The noise of the oars from beyond stopped, and a weak voice could be heard trying to answer. The priest had a feeling that he had heard this voice somewhere before, but he could not recall where.